Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming to this morning's Grand Rounds. This morning, Dr. Angelina Tate, who is working at the Lynn Cancer Center as a hematologist-oncologist, is going to give us a presentation on leukemias. Dr. Tate went to undergrad at University of Florida. She's a Gator, but she went to medical school at University of Miami, because she's also a Hurricane. And then she went to University of North Carolina for her residency, and then Alabama for her hematology oncology fellowship. So it is my pleasure to welcome her to give us a talk this morning on leukemias.
Thank you for having me this morning. So the purpose of my talk today is really just to provide an overview of the most common leukemias that we encounter in practice, and also to help provide some review for board testing. So the topics that I'll be covering today are myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myeloid leukemia. Now, MDS technically is not a leukemia. However, this is oftentimes considered a pre-leukemia state, and it's important to sort of understand the physiology of that in leading up to AML. The other topics include acute lymphoblastic leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, chronic myeloid leukemia, and a less common type of leukemia called hairy cell leukemia. So it's always important to kind of go back and the science of all of this and understand where these cells are coming from. So when we talk about blood cells, these originate from the so-called pluripotent stem cell. The pluripotent stem cell has the potential to develop into any potential type of cell in the body. Through multiple stages of maturation and development, it develops into what's called a hematopoietic stem cell, which then has two primary divisions, including the myeloid stem cell lineage and the lymphoid stem cell lineage. And so the myeloid stem cell lineage is the lineage that creates all of the blood cells, as we know, including the erythrocytes, the red blood cells, platelets, neutrophils, monocytes, which then go on to become macrophages, eosinophils, and basophils, which differentiates into mast cells. The lymphoid stem cell lineage includes both the B and the T cell lymphocytes. The B cells are commonly considered the cells that help to identify antigens on pathogens, and the T cells are the cells that help to destroy infected blood cells through cytokines. The B cells can also terminally differentiate into plasma cells, which are the primary cells that help produce antibodies to fight infection. These are the cells that are part of our so-called adaptive immune system. So MDS is basically a spectrum of clonal or neoplastic myeloid disorders characterized by ineffective hematopoiesis. So oftentimes these are cells that are growing and going through division, but then go through an arrest of maturation. As a result, there can be low production of blood cells, including low white blood cells, low red cells, and low platelets. And it's not just a quantitative condition, a disorder, but it's also a qualitative disorder where oftentimes, even though you may have maybe normal numbers of white blood cells or platelets, they are not working properly. So you may see a greater risk of infection and bleeding and bruising. One of the typical characteristics of MDS disorders are the presence of chromosomal abnormalities, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, as many of these abnormalities have prognostic significance. And there is a variable predilection for these disorders to evolve into a more aggressive type of blood condition, such as AML. On average, approximately 1 out of 3 cases of MDS will transform into AML ultimately. In general, MDS is a condition of older patients. It's rarely seen in patients under the age of 50, but increases in incidence as one gets older on the age spectrum. There are about 10 or more thousand cases annually in the United States, and this interestingly affects more men than women for reasons that are unclear. We do know that while many of cases of MDS occur de novo, there have been risk factors that have been linked to the development of MDS, including prior exposure to ionizing radiation. Sometimes that can occur 10, 20 years after exposure. If patients have had prior exposure to chemotherapy or industrial chemicals, such as benzene, paint thinners, these are known risk factors for the development of MDS. And there are also congenital disorders that can also increase one's risk for MDS, such as Down syndrome. Depicted here is a patient with Fanconi anemia, which is a rare genetic condition where oftentimes patients will have abnormal development of their thumbs and these cafe au lait spots. Those are typical for this condition. The diagnosis is made by a number of modalities. For example, one can look at the peripheral blood smear of a patient, and there may be some characteristics that might typify MDS. But we also look at other tests such as flow cytometry, cytogenetics, and molecular markers. The diagnosis of MDS is confirmed by doing a bone marrow biopsy. We perform many of the same tests in the bone marrow as we do in the peripheral blood. The bone marrow biopsy is really the most accurate assessment of marrow cellularity. It gives us an information about the overall topography of the bone marrow, stromal changes, and percentage of blasts and immature cells. So it really gives us the definitive information regarding MDS. Here are some what are called pseudo-Pelger-Hewitt cells. This is a oftentimes late manifestation of patients with MDS. This is a neutrophil characterized by a bilobed nucleus, which is fairly, classic for patients with late-stage MDS. It often has this sort of eyeglass appearance where you have this bilobed nucleus connected with a very thin strand of chromatin. In this picture here, there's what we call typical dysplastic changes, where we have a cell with a very sort of misshapen nucleus. This is what classifies the dysplasia that we see in MDS. So the symptoms of MDS would be what you might expect for someone presenting with perhaps low blood counts, the pallor that we might see in someone with anemia, weakness, increased risk of infections in people who have low white blood cells or qualitatively poor white blood cells, bleeding or bruising in someone with low platelets, and arthralgias, which is interesting, but it can occur in patients with bone marrow expansion when there's rapid turnover of blood cells within the bone marrow itself. Many of these cases, however, do occur asymptomatically. Oftentimes, blood count abnormalities can be picked up during routine blood testing. The diagnostic criteria of MDS include at least 10% of cells of at least one myeloid bone marrow lineage showing unequivocal dysplasia. Other causes of secondary dysplasia should be ruled out. For example, patients with a history of excess alcohol use, B12 deficiency, sometimes those types of conditions can create dysplastic changes and are typically temporary. And if there's any question, a bone marrow biopsy should be repeated again in the future to confirm. If morphologic features are inconclusive, which is oftentimes the case in cases where there are subtle changes, a presumptive diagnosis can be made if clonal abnormalities can be detected. Whenever we do a bone marrow biopsy, we always send off cytogenetic and FISH studies, and these allow us now to detect chromosomal changes that might indicate the presence of a clonal abnormality. There is a prognostic staging system for MDS, and this is not something that you need to memorize, but basically the scoring system is based on the presence of the presence of blasts in the bone marrow. The blasts are the immature myeloid elements that have not gone through differentiation. The presence of karyotypic abnormalities and the presence of cytopenias. Based on the score that's calculated, one can be labeled as having low, intermediate, or high-risk disease. And based on the results, one can estimate what their prognosis might be based on those characteristics. There's also a way in which we can determine how high one's risk of developing AML is based on those prognostic characteristics. This is a what's called a ringed sideroblast, which is also typical for patients with MDS. This is a red blood cell precursor where there's significant iron accumulation or deposition in the mitochondria surrounding the nucleus. There's no cure, unfortunately, for MDS with conventional methods. Treatment revolves mostly around supportive care with growth factor support, with recombinant erythropoietin, Proquit, or Aranesp, or any of the biosimilars that we're mostly using today, including Retacrit. Patients oftentimes will require blood transfusions if they develop progressive cytopenias over time. Unfortunately, this can lead to iron overload, and iron chelation therapies are often incorporated in the treatment of these patients. For patients who have a high need for transfusions or who have evidence for a high number of myeloblasts within the bone marrow, one of the treatments that have been demonstrated to slow the progression to AML and also help reduce the potential need for blood transfusions are the so-called hypomethylating agents, including 5-azacitidine and decitabine. These are treatments that are not curative but may help to slow the process of MDS into evolving into a more aggressive type of condition. For rare types of MDS where there's more of a aplastic presentation, sometimes immunotherapies, including steroids, cyclosporin, and lenalidomide may be helpful. The only potential curative method that we have for treatment of MDS is stem cell transplant. However, stem cell transplantation is a fairly aggressive treatment associated with a lot of short-term and long-term toxicities, including the short-term risk for infection, need for multiple blood transfusions and blood product support, and potential for both acute and chronic graft versus host disease, and the potential need for long-term immunosuppression down the road. So stem cell transplant is generally reserved for patients with high-risk MDS and patients who are physically fit to proceed with treatment. Now, the treatment with stem cell transplant has evolved over time, and there are less intensive conditioning methods that are being used now that are available for older patients. However, many institutions are using an age cutoff of around age 70 in order to proceed with this treatment. All right, so we're going to go ahead and move forward with acute myeloid leukemia. So AML basically represents an accumulation of abnormal myeloblasts in the blood, bone marrow, and organs. The diagnosis is made if there are at least 20% or more myeloblasts in the marrow or blood. The only exception to this rule is if there are typical core binding factor translocations that are identified or the presence of the translocation 1517, which is what typifies acute promyelocytic leukemia. The blasts that are noted in AML are typically large cells that have a high nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio. Oftentimes, and it doesn't really project so well on this picture, but you can see what are called arrow rods, which are needle-like projections within the cytoplasm, and these represent sort of granules that have coalesced together within the cytoplasm. So historically, whenever we make a diagnosis of AML, the treatment is based on risk stratification of the both the patient and the disease itself. Again, in the past, age was used as sort of a rough cutoff of who would be an appropriate candidate for aggressive versus non-aggressive treatments, young being defined as anyone age 65 or less, and older being described as, you know, patients over the age of 65, although we know that life is more complicated than that. And, you know, we understand now that treatment-related mortality is not just based on age alone, but also on a number of other factors, including socioeconomic status, the presence of other comorbidities, and social support. Patients who have insurance, patients who cohabitate with others, seem to do better than patients who live alone and who lack insurance. We also know that risk is can be defined by the presence of certain genetic characteristics that increase one's risk for treatment resistance. And the genetics is the information regarding genetics is gathered based on the cytogenetic information and next generation sequencing studies that we can now do on bone marrow biopsy. So I know this is a very busy slide, but unfortunately, in this age of precision medicine, we're really not able to have a conversation about AML treatment without going through some of the more nitty-gritty details on the cytogenetic characteristics of AML. And in large part, that's due because we have a lot of targeted treatments that are now available in the past 5 years that we hadn't had available before. So we know that there are certain cytogenetic abnormalities that typify more favorable disease and cytogenetic characteristics that are more adverse. The more favorable AML cytogenetic abnormalities include the core binding factor abnormalities, which include the 821 translocation, inversion 16 or translocation 1616. The acute promyelocytic leukemias are characterized by the translocation of chromosomes 15 and 17. And then there are also other genetic mutations that we can identify, again, by next-generation sequencing. This isn't a slide to be memorized, but any time you see complex karyotype or abnormalities involving 17P, which carries the proto-oncogene TP53, these typically indicate very poor prognosis. The European Leukemia Network is a large organization that has stratified AML risk categories. And as based on the previous slide, if you fall into the favorable category, your outcome really isn't still that favorable. Overall survival at 5 years in many of these cases for favorable disease is less than 40%. And there's almost an imperceptible difference between outcomes in patients with intermediate risk disease and adverse risk disease. So in general, in adults, this is a disease with a poor overall outlook. The diagnosis is made, again, on multiple modalities. One might consider looking at a peripheral blood smear for a patient who presents with high white blood cell count or other concerning changes. Bone marrow biopsy is the gold standard for making the diagnosis of AML. And from the bone marrow biopsy, we're able to gather information on abnormal CD expression, which is the proteins on the surface of the cells that can be markers of clonality. Cytogenetics is still performed. It's helpful in identifying certain favorable, intermediate, or adverse characteristics. And we also now have the ability to do next-generation sequencing, which is a new technology, also known as high-throughput sequencing, which has really revolutionized the way that we treat AML and allows us to sequence multiple, millions of DNA base pairs with one swift look. And it's cut down a lot on the cost of the evaluation. The previous method, the Sanger method, was a much more costly and time-consuming method. So just to go over some of the terminology, again, we don't have to go through this is not necessarily something to be memorized, but the initial goal of AML therapy is to achieve a complete remission. And that's done by what's called induction therapy. And that's where you basically give intensive therapy to achieve a state where there's no further measurable residual disease. There's various options here. For patients who are physically fit and young, we generally consider intensive therapy with what's called 7+3. 7+3 has been the standard of care for many years up until recently, and this generally refers to 7 days of a chemotherapy drug called cytarabine and 3 days of an anthracycline. Typically, idarubicin or daunorubicin are used. For patients who we can detect with the FLT3 mutation, there is a specific FLT3 inhibitor called midostaurin that is now FDA approved to be used in combination with 7+3. And for patients who are expressors of the CD33 protein, these patients are also candidates for gemtuzumab in combination with 7+3. There's also a newer drug available called Vyxeos, which is a liposomal version of 7+3, which has a greater penetration of bone marrow and pharmacokinetically lasts longer than 7+3. For less fit patients, those with multiple comorbidities or elderly patients, those who are deemed to have a higher treatment-related morbidity and mortality, there are less intensive regimens that are available, including the hypomethylating agents, which we had already referred to with MDS, as well as the IDH2 inhibitors, which are the inacetinib and ivosidenib. Venetoclax is a BCL2 inhibitor, which is also used in treatment of certain lymphomas and CLL, and this can also be combined with the hypomethylating agents as well as low-dose cytarabine. And these are improving upon outcomes, although overall survival is still quite grim in many of the elderly and unfit patients. Because the outcomes are not great in all of these patients, even those with so-called favorable characteristic AML, clinical trials are always reasonable to consider as well. Consolidation is a therapy that follows induction therapy, and typically this consists of additional chemotherapy with the idea of maintaining disease remission. In patients who are physically fit and who have intermediate or adverse risk disease, we oftentimes will consider stem cell transplant if there is an available donor. We usually look at a matched related sibling. However, if a matched related sibling is unavailable, we look at the National Bone Marrow Registry. Patients who are not fit for stem cell transplant are oftentimes considered for intermediate or high dose cytarabine and completing anywhere from 2 to 3 cycles of that. Salvage therapy just simply refers to the therapy that's given for patients who have refractory disease or who have relapsed after initial remission state. I just want to spend a little time on acute promyelocytic leukemia. This is a fairly rare subtype of AML. It comprises less than 10% of all AMLs, and it's characterized by a very distinctive blast morphology. Typically, these cells are highly granular. The disease is also characterized by coagulopathy at time of disease presentation. Almost all of these patients present with DIC. And if they can survive the initial part of their diagnosis, then in many cases, this is a highly curable disease. APL is characterized by the fusion of a gene, the promyelocytic leukemia gene on chromosome 15, to the retinoic acid receptor gene on chromosome 17. And this fusion protein results in uncontrolled cell proliferation and inhibition of cell differentiation. This is a typical cell, acute promyelocytic leukemia cell. You can appreciate the presence of highly granular cytoplasm, and it projects a little bit better these hour rods, which again are basically granules that have coalesced together within the cytoplasm. You can see them throughout. This is a FISH study, which is a fluorescent in situ hybridization study looking specifically for the translocation of 1517. This is what it will look like, where you can see the fusion of the two proteins together. So the goal of acute promyelocytic leukemia is cure, but it is also prevention of early death. Whenever the diagnosis is considered, we initially will start a vitamin A derivative called all-trans-retinoic acid. Sometimes it can take up to a week to get a final diagnosis following a bone marrow biopsy and testing through cytogenetic analysis. But if there is concern that this could be the condition based on the presence of a coagulopathy, then it is pertinent and crucial to start ATRA right away. It is also important to manage the coagulopathy as best as possible, providing support through blood products as needed, and closely monitoring coagulation parameters. Since around 2013, there was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine showing a trial that showed that a non-chemotherapy approach for patients with low-risk APL is superior to chemotherapy, and that consists of a regimen of all-trans-retinoic acid, or ATRA, in combination with arsenic trioxide. Non-high-risk patients are defined as patients with a white blood cell count less than 10, whereas high-risk patients are those that are presenting with white blood cell counts greater than 10. For high-risk patients, we generally combine ATRA with chemotherapy. In some countries, we're also able to use arsenic in combination with ATRA and chemotherapy, although it's not approved in the United States for high-risk patients at this time. All right, so moving along, the next leukemia that I'm going to review is acute lymphoblastic leukemia. This is a fairly rare form of leukemia, affecting about 6,000 to 7,000 new patients per year. ALL has a bimodal distribution in terms of incidence. It has a peak, first peak in childhood, and then a second peak around age 50. The outcomes, however, are largely discrepant between the pediatric and adult population. It's a highly curable disease in pediatric patients, but unfortunately is associated with poor outcomes in adults. Many cases present de novo. However, like MDS and AML, it can be associated with certain congenital disorders such as Down syndrome, Fanconi anemia, Bloom syndrome, ataxia telangiectasia, Nijmegen breakdown syndrome. It's also been associated with prior exposure to radiation and industrial chemicals, as well as prior viral exposures. And essentially, this is a disease where there's an abnormal proliferation and differentiation of a clonal population of lymphoid cells. And like AML and MDS, it can be associated with specific chromosomal aberrations. And some of these chromosomal aberrations, particularly the Philadelphia chromosome, which is a translocation between chromosomes 9 and 22, can carry prognostic significance. The Philadelphia chromosome is present in up to 50% or so of cases, and typically carries a poor prognosis. Historically, the French, American, British criteria was used to classify ALL, but the more contemporary classification is a World Health Organization classification scheme, which classifies ALL into B-cell ALL, T-cell ALL, or Burkitt cell leukemia. By far and away, the B-cell subtype of ALL is the most common. As I previously indicated, patients who carry the Philadelphia chromosome tend to do worse. Also, if you're older or have a complex or hypodiploid karyotype, prognosis tends to be worse. This is a typical cytogenetic profile of a patient with ALL. In addition to translocation 922, there's also evidence for deletion 7 in this particular case. The treatments for ALL there are many choices, and many of the regimens are based on pediatric protocols. Again, sort of using the same nomenclature as we used for AML. For healthy and fit patients, we usually recommend a series of treatments, starting from induction, moving on to consolidation and maintenance. For ALL, this treatment can go on for 2 or more years. For eligible patients, we also consider allogeneic stem cell transplant. For Philadelphia-positive carriers, we also include the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, including imatinib, dasatinib, and ponatinib. I'll spend a little more time on that when we talk about CML. With ALL, there's a high predilection for CNS involvement, and so intrathecal therapy is crucial in the treatment of all these patients. For elderly and infirm patients, the treatment for ALL is poorly defined. Typically, it's palliative in nature and consists of steroids in combination with tyrosine kinase inhibitors if Philadelphia chromosome is present. Oftentimes, we use less intensive forms of the protocols that are used for more healthier, fit patients. But again, this is an area of unmet need. Stem cell transplantation is considered for patients with ALL with relapse refractory disease, and anyone with high-risk disease, including patients with the Philadelphia chromosome. And it's also considered for patients with so-called standard risk disease who have detectable minimal residual disease. Minimal residual disease is any disease that's detectable by some of the technology that we now have, including flow cytometry, FISH, next-generation sequencing. Anyone with residual disease has a potential higher risk for recurrence down the road, and therefore more intensive consolidation with stem cell transplant can be considered in those cases. Okay, so the most common form of leukemia that we encounter probably in this country is chronic lymphocytic leukemia. There are about 15,000 new cases per year. Median age of diagnosis is around age 72. Again, there tends to be more males than females that are affected with this disease. This is basically a clonal proliferation and accumulation of mature monoclonal B cells within the blood, bone marrow, lymph nodes, and spleen. And we believe that CLL is probably initiated by the loss or addition of large amounts of chromosomal material, followed by additional mutations that can render the CLL more aggressive over time. With the theme overall with when we talk about prognosis is the presence of specific chromosomal abnormalities, and we heard this in MDS, AML, and ALL, and we see it also in CLL. We know that there are certain chromosomal aberrations that do predict for more favorable or more adverse prognosis, and these are the ones listed here. Again, anything with deletion 17p carries generally a very poor prognosis no matter what type of hematologic disease it is. We also know that in addition to genetic abnormalities, there's an important role that the microenvironment plays that can help predict prognosis over time. The diagnosis requires the presence of over 5,000 B lymphocytes per microliter of in the peripheral blood for a duration of 3 or more months. In general, the cells in the blood smear are typically small, mature lymphocytes with a narrow border of cytoplasm and a dense nucleus. And this is one of the few diagnoses that can be made without a bone marrow biopsy. It can be confirmed by showing the typical immunophenotypic expression of CD5 positivity, CD19, low CD20 expression, and positive CD23 expression. This is a typical picture of CLL cells, again, with a high nuclear to cytoplasm ratio. Oftentimes, you can see somewhat prominent nucleoli within the nucleus. But these cells are generally considered to be mature. They're oftentimes just slightly greater than the size of a red blood cell. In the differential, it's important to exclude other forms of leukemia that can present in a similar way, including prolymphocytic leukemia, which tends to carry a more aggressive natural biology and course of disease. small lymphocytic lymphoma, which morphologically is similar to CLL, except it presents more with bulky adenopathy and organomegaly. Typically, patients with SLL have less than 5,000 B lymphocytes. And now with the technology that we have, we're able to detect monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis, which is defined by less than 5,000 B lymphocytes per microliter of blood. And typically in this condition, there aren't any cytopenias, lymph node enlargement, or organomegaly. Much like MGUS is for multiple myeloma, MBL carries a very low risk for transformation to CLL, approximately 1% to 2% per year. The most common risk stratification scheme that we use in the United States is probably the RIE risk schedule. It used to compose of five different levels of risk, but now it's been more simplified to three levels of low risk, intermediate risk, or poor risk, depending on the clinical manifestations of the disease. Another way in which we can delineate prognosis is through what's called the International Prognostic Index Scoring System. And it weighs five different prognostic factors, including the presence or absence of TP53 dysfunction, immunoglobulin heavy chain mutation status, beta 2 microglobulin, clinical stage, and age. And depending on the category that a patient may fall into, their overall survival can be predicted. And in many cases, for patients with low to intermediate risk, treatment is not necessary. Typically, we don't treat this disease unless symptoms are present. Treating early stage disease has never been shown to result in any survival benefit. Treatment indications for CLL include the presence of progressive marrow failure, massive or symptomatic splenomegaly, progressive or enlarging lymph nodes, the presence of progressive lymphocytosis as measured by a 50% increase over 2 months or a doubling of lymphocytes in 6 months or less. Autoimmune complications are frequent complications of CLL, including autoimmune hemolytic anemia and ITP. And if poorly responsive to steroids, then one should consider initiating treatment for the CLL. CLL can also be associated with the so-called B symptoms, including weight loss, fatigue, fevers, and night sweats. Typically, weight loss is considered greater than 10% of baseline body weight. So the treatment of CLL has really evolved over time. In the past, chemotherapy was the principal treatment used to address this disease, including chlorambucil and a combination of drugs called FCR. Now, however, we employ multiple different forms of antibodies, including a variety of different anti-CD20 antibodies, including Rituxan, ofatumumab, and obinutuzumab. In certain cases of aggressive disease or those presenting with TP53 mutations, anti-CD52 antibody therapy has been utilized. However, in the past 5 to 10 years, again, there have been an emergence of multiple new cell signaling pathway inhibitors, including ibrutinib and acalabrutinib. These are Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have really revolutionized the way that we treat this disease and are resulting in longer outcomes. There's also now PIK3 inhibitors available, BCL2 inhibitors, and for patients with resistant or highly refractory disease, there's a new form of immunotherapy, which many of you have, I'm sure, heard of, called CAR-T therapy, which is a form of immunotherapy where patients' T cells are removed from their body and engineered to identify certain pathogens on the CLL cells themselves. And we're already using this technology for patients with ALL and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. It's being heavily studied in CLL and also in patients with multiple myeloma currently. In many cases now with the treatments that we have, patients with CLL are doing quite well and are achieving what's called essentially a functional cure, not an actual cure where we can still detect the disease, where we can't detect the disease. In fact, with these treatments, we're getting closer and closer to achieving eradication of minimal residual disease. The selection of therapy really depends on the overall clinical stage of disease, symptoms, the fitness of the patient, presence of other comorbidities, genetic risks, and which line of therapy they've already gotten. All right, so CML is a fairly uncommon form of leukemia. It's considered a myeloproliferative neoplasm. It accounts for about 15% of newly diagnosed cases of leukemia, about 9,000 new cases per year. The diagnosis is typified by the presence of the Philadelphia chromosome, which is the fusion of the ABL gene on chromosome 9 with the breakpoint cluster region gene on chromosome 22. And that results in a specific protein fusion, which causes constitutive activation of a tyrosine kinase that promotes cell growth and replication. So again, the translocation is depicted here on this karyotype map, where you can see an exchange of information between genetic material between chromosomes 9 and 22. And it's actually chromosome 22 here, that's the so-called Philadelphia chromosome. So many cases are asymptomatic. Oftentimes, patients will present with abnormal labs when they go through routine blood testing or preoperative lab testing. Symptoms oftentimes stem from the presence of anemia and splenomegaly. Patients may have weight loss and early satiety symptoms if they have an enlarged spleen that's pushing against their stomach. Oftentimes they can feel fatigue and weight and generalized malaise. The majority of cases present in chronic phase. However, there are more aggressive presentations, including accelerated and blast phases, where there's a higher percentage of blasts noted in the bone marrow and in the peripheral blood. And these are cases that are treated much more aggressively than those in chronic phase. The diagnosis is made by confirming the presence of the Philadelphia chromosome. We generally still recommend, even though a diagnosis can be made on peripheral blood, we still recommend doing a bone marrow biopsy, as it provides prognostic information as well with respect to the percentage of blasts present in the bone marrow. It's important to differentiate CML from other conditions, such as a leukemoid reaction. Typically, leukemoid reactions present with white blood cell counts less than 50,000. We sometimes see this in patients with acute illness or in patients who are on high-dose steroids. And it's also important to rule out other myeloproliferative neoplasms. Sometimes there can be a lot of overlapping clinical manifestations, including high white blood cell count and splenomegaly, with some of the other myeloproliferative neoplasms, such as essential thrombocytosis and polycythemia vera. In the year 2000, imatinib became available to treat CML, and it really revolutionized the treatment for this disease. It reduced the annual mortality of CML from about 10 to 20% to only about 1 to 2%. It works by competitively inhibiting the ATP binding site of the BCR-ABL oncoprotein. Now there are multiple second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors, including dasatinib, nilotinib, and bosutinib. These achieve more rapid cytogenetic and molecular remission states. And in many cases, with the availability of these second-generation TKIs, we can now consider discontinuing treatment in patients who are able to achieve a molecular remission for 3 or more years and who are willing to commit to monthly follow-up. About 50% who discontinue treatment with TKIs can go on to have prolonged durations of immeasurable disease. However, about 50% of people who do discontinue treatment do need to restart their treatment again due to reemergence of a detectable clone in their blood. Ponatinib is a third-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which is approved for patients with resistant forms of CML, particularly those who have the 315I mutation. stem cell transplant, which used to be used as a frontline option for these patients pre-imatinib, is now reserved for patients who have more aggressive presentations of disease, those who present with accelerated or blast phase disease, typically after failure of two prior TKIs, and then those with mutations that predict for treatment resistance. With any of the commonly used tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we can see a fairly common set of side effects with those medications. With imatinib or Gleevec, there's commonly weight gain, fatigue, the presence of peripheral and periorbital edema, arthralgias, and nausea. One of the common side effects of Sprycel is the presence of pleural effusions, and so we try not to use this medication for anyone who has history of primary lung disease. With nilotinib, we can see hyperglycemia, QT prolongation, and a higher risk for vaso-occlusive disease. So in patients with diabetes or patients with a higher risk of, with a history of stroke or heart attack, we try to avoid the use of nilotinib. The goal of this of therapy is by 6 months to achieve a cytogenetic remission, and by 12 months to achieve molecular remission. And so we oftentimes will see these patients and follow up every 3 months. Once they achieve a cytogenetic remission, we'll see them every 6 months. And if they don't achieve these particular goals, it raises questions on whether we should consider switching to an alternative tyrosine kinase inhibitor. With the treatments, again, that we have these days, these patients are achieving basically normal lifespans, and in many cases, functional cures. Just want to spend a little bit of time on hairy cell leukemia. It's a very rare form of leukemia, accounting for about 2% of all leukemias. It occurs more frequently in men than women. The name comes from the appearance on peripheral blood smear examination, where you see these cytoplasmic extensions coming out the periphery of the cells. Oftentimes, these patients can present with splenomegaly. They can have low white blood cell counts or dysfunctional white blood cells, resulting in a higher risk of infection. Patients can also present with anemia, fatigue, and low platelets. This is a picture of a large spleen that has been removed of a patient with hairy cell leukemia that has this very typical beefy red appearance. The diagnosis is made based on a number of different testing studies, including examination of the CBC, peripheral smear. Flow cytometry establishes B cell clonality, and patients with hairy cell leukemia have a very characteristic profile of CD11C expression, CD103, CD123, and CD25. Interestingly, about 80 to 90% of patients with hairy cell leukemia carry a BRAF mutation. BRAF is a mutation that is oftentimes encountered in patients with various malignancies, including melanoma and lung cancer. It's also present in patients with colon cancer. The prognosis is actually quite similar to CLL. Poor prognosis is associated with patients who express the CD38 protein, who have unmutated immunoglobulin heavy variable chain regions, and those who have variable chain 4 through 34 point mutations. In many cases, these patients can be observed initially if they are asymptomatic. For symptomatic patients, cure can be achieved in patients who undergo chemotherapy with cladribine or pentostatin. For patients with relapsed or refractory disease, there are BRAF inhibitors that can be used for these patients. However, many of these patients do quite well nowadays. So that's actually the end of my talk, but I do have some mix-up questions if anyone is interested. So I have two of them. I'll go through the first one. So first question, 35-year-old male presents to the ER with fever and epistaxis. He's been experiencing malaise for several weeks, as well as fevers, chills, and anorexia. He developed epistaxis. He takes no medications. He is febrile. Blood pressure is 105 over 70, pulse is 110, respiration rate is 24. He's diaphoretic. He has some dried blood in his nares, and gingival bleeding is present. He does not have any lymphadenopathy or hepatosplenomegaly. He does have petechiae on his legs. His labs show that he has a prolonged PTT of 60 seconds. He is anemic, hemoglobin 9.8. White blood cell count is low. He has what appears to be 18% atypical cells in his peripheral blood. He has a very low platelet count. PT is prolonged at 24. Fibrinogen is very low at 93. The peripheral blood smear shows immature leukocytes with prominent granules within the cytoplasm. What is the most likely diagnosis? Correct, yes. So the key tip-off is the presence of a coagulopathy. It sounds like this patient has DIC with prolonged coag times, and also his fibrinogen level is very low. And DIC is one of the common manifestations of acute promyelocytic leukemia. For a patient like this, even before diagnosis is established, you'd want to start ATRA right away. Once the diagnosis is made, for him, given his low white blood cell count, he would be considered low-risk disease, and he could be considered for non-chemotherapy approach with ATRA and arsenic trioxide. All right, second question. So this is a 35-year-old male who presents with a six-month history of night sweats, malaise, and 25-pound weight loss. He reports no fevers or other localizing symptoms. He only takes Tylenol. His vital signs are normal. His abdominal exam reveals splenomegaly. The remainder of his exam is non-contributory. So his white count is 55. He has sort of a variable distribution of different white blood cells. There's no mention of blasts here. His hemoglobin is fairly normal, borderline. Platelets are increased. PCR for BCR-ABL is positive. His bone marrow biopsy shows a hypercellular marrow with myeloid hyperplasia and 1% myeloblasts. Which of the following is most appropriate? C, right. So this is a gentleman who is presenting with chronic myeloid leukemia. He has a high rate of achieving a very good cytogenetic and molecular response with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor such as imatinib. Any questions? Yes.
As a person who's worked with solid tumors in GI tract, we always say, well, what country are you from and what environmental exposure do you have and what viruses have you been exposed to like that? But I hear none of that in the leukemias at all, as if everybody's at the same risk other than sort of big genetic chromosomal abnormality.
Yeah. So there are actually a greater predilection of certain leukemias with certain viral exposures. So with Epstein-Barr virus, which is oftentimes prevalent among Asian and African nations, we tend to see a greater incidence of ALL in those cases. But, I focus mainly on the United States, but there can be a greater predilection for certain forms of ALL in those types of areas where there's more EBV exposure. Yes?
Yeah. Going back to trying to differentiate to the reactions, how valuable is it that phosphatase?
Yeah, that previously, historically, was used quite often, and we still use it these days. If you have a low score, that argues against CML. It's sort of a more rapid testing, like a point of care testing almost, whereas a FISH analysis can take a little bit longer to come back, although the rapidity of the result is getting better now. With a FISH analysis, the results typically come back in about 48 hours, so it's almost replaced and it's a more sensitive test for that disease. All right, well, thank you so much. Thank you.